From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now!
I was so honored when Bob Dole asked me to give tonight's keynote speech. And I have some really good news for you. This speech is a lot like a Bill Clinton promise. It won't last long, and it'll sound like a Republican talking.
We take a look at the women of the night at the GOP convention, Susan Molinari and Christine Todd Whitman. Activists try to expose how much Philip Morris is coughing up to wine and dine Republican Party power brokers, and right-wing watch Jack Kemp's ties to the Christian right. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in San Diego, joined by our national affairs correspondent Larry Venske and daily news columnist, that's New York daily news columnist, Juan Gonzalez. Well, Juan and Larry, last night in primetime, the Republican National Committee presented an all-star lineup of women of the GOP. It was a clear attempt to narrow the gender gap that's plaguing Bob Dole's presidential candidacy and that many say he is obsessed by. What did you think?
I don't know how dumb they think women are in this country, but if that was supposed to be an appeal to close the gender gap, I think it was pretty appalling. Basically, it seemed to focus more on dress and style than substance to an unreal degree. You know how reporters are always interviewing taxi cab drivers when they first come to town, and that's what you read about? Well, I interviewed my shuttle bus driver last night who listened to this Molinari speech, and I asked him what he thought, and he said, "She didn't say how we were ever going to get any of that done." And I think what he was, when he said that, I specifically thought of the passage where Molinari said, "Medicare will be bankrupt in less than 5 years. Our president would rather pay politics than muster the political courage to rescue it. Republicans will save Medicare and protect Social Security." And then on to the next topic. No about how on this very critical economic issue.
Yeah, I think as a keynote, it definitely failed. The real keynote of this convention so far has been Colin Powell's speech, without a doubt, and I think that Molinari was almost like a cheerleader for the party, and I think that the fact is that she came across as even younger than she actually is in a convention where the number of people under 30 you could practically count on one hand. It's all packaging. And I think that many Americans, unfortunately, one of the problems we're having is that the media coverage, the televised media coverage, is not really showing the American people what this convention is like.
You mean, Juan, you're not seeing the same thing inside the convention hall as we're seeing on television outside?
And the composition of the delegates. I think that by the end of this convention, every African-American delegate will have been on television at least three times on every station.
FaceTime for them. Yeah, the cutaways to the audience during Colin Powell, the New York Times did an analysis of it this morning and said, what is it, that 20% of the people shown are African-Americans, where the actual number here is fewer than 3%?
Fewer than 3% of all minorities.
Of all minorities, and that the number of African-American delegates is half of what it was even 4 years ago.
I mean, this is very important. It's not only African-Americans, women also down, and yet you have a very different picture because of what is on and who is on the podium.
Right.
Well, I don't know what the whole net effect of this is. It's clearly being staged as a television show, and that's the way the media critics are more and more looking at it.
In football parlance, it's faint to the left, run to the right.
Faint to the left, run to the right. But the faint to the left, I think, last night was not so apparent even in the women as in Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich got up there, and what's the first thing out of his mouth? The greatest Georgian of the 20th century is Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, if ever a human being could be said to be turning over in his or her grave, it would be Martin Luther King. Not only with that reference, but with William Bennett the other day saying if Martin Luther King were alive, he would be endorsing CCRI, the California Civil Rights Initiative, because he wanted to call them. I mean, what are these people trying to say?
Let's not forget Jack Kemp. When Bob Dole introduced him, when he first named him as the vice presidential candidate in Russell, Kansas, Jack Kemp ended with a quote of Martin Luther King.
Well, talking about CCRI, I was at the National Latino Summit yesterday that was held here outside the convention, and most of the people there were still praising Jack Kemp for his stand against CCRI.
Not realizing
California,
he changed.
Not realizing that he already announced he switched his position.
Now, that's very important. I don't know if our listeners realize that, but two nights ago on NBC, talking to Tom Brokaw, he said, I mean, it was quite unabashed. Yes, he is now in support of the California Civil Rights Initiative, what many call the California Civil Wrongs Initiative. He is now, because he's joined Bob Dole, joined the attack on affirmative action. But it wasn't just Susan Molinari and Christine Todd Whitman who spoke last night. Yes, there have been other women through the days, and one of them was Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison.
America, it's time to wake up, America, to President Clinton and his high-taxing, free-spending, promise-breaking, Social Security taxing, healthcare socializing, drug-coddling, power-grabbing, business-busting, lawsuit-loving, UN-following, FBI-abusing, IRS-increasing, $200 hair-cutting, gas-taxing, over-regulating, bureaucracy-trusting, class-baiting, privacy-violating, values-crushing, truth-dodging, Medicare-forsaking, property rights-taking, job-destroying friends, and that's just in the White House.
Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison last night at the GOP convention. One of the other things she said, and I've heard this said before at the GOP podium over this last 2 days, is she said, it doesn't take a village to raise a child, of course, referring to the title of Hillary Clinton's book. She says, it takes a family. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it takes money. And the one thing that the Republicans tend not to talk about is how wealth is so unequally distributed in this society. And, of course, it would ill behoove them to speak about it since, what, 20% of the delegates here are millionaires and the average net worth of the people on the floor is well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But, you know, this whole emphasis, in part, Amy, it's part of the whole emphasis on so-called freedom, the power of the individual. This reached to me the height of total rhetorical absurdity last night when Newt Gingrich, at the beginning of his speech, said, the lesson of freedom can be seen in the fact that beach volleyball is now an Olympic sport. And he had an Olympic medal.
That was before his reference to Martin
right,
Luther King.
I'm not joking. He actually did this. When I first came on, I saw this Olympic guy with his medal on next to him. I said, what is he going to do with this prop? And the fact is that this man shows how much freedom there is, because this man had a dream that Olympic volleyball would someday be a beach volleyball would someday be Olympic sport, and by God, he lived that dream and he won the gold medal. Well, and that's what America's all about.
You know, I have to say, Juan and I were sitting in the media lounge, sponsored by one of the many corporations that are here at the GOP convention, and we were sitting next to a reporter who, when he heard that speech, he said, beach volleyball and Martin Luther King in the same speech. What have we come to? Well, folks, you're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're going to start off with the woman who has been highly touted ever since Bob Dole announced the fact that she was going to be the keynote speaker on Larry King Live. Yes, this all is all a big TV show. We're now going to talk about New York Congressmember Susan Molinari.
Now, think about Bill Clinton. He promises one thing and does another. He hopes we'll forget his broken promises. But I ask you, have you forgotten that Bill Clinton promised a middle-class tax cut, then passed the largest tax increase in American history? I didn't think so. Have you forgotten that Bill Clinton promised common-sense health care reform, only to impose a huge Washington-run bureaucracy health care system on all of us? And have you forgotten that Bill Clinton promised to balance the budget first in 5 years, then 10, then 7, then 9, then went on to veto the first balanced budget in 25 years?
No!
Americans know that Bill Clinton's promises have the lifespan of a Big Mac on Air Force One.
No!
Lovely product placement last night at the GOP convention. That's New York Congressmember Susan Molinari. And we're joined by two people who've been following her. We're joined by Jennifer Gonerman of The Village Voice, who's written several pieces on her profiles and also written a piece this week in The Voice. We're also joined by Judy Randall, and she has been following Susan Molinari for the last 7 years as she's the political reporter on Staten Island, the borough that Susan Molinari represents, Staten Island, New York, for the Staten Island Advance. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now. Why don't you give us a profile of who Susan Molinari is? And I think it's interesting to look at this because of the way the media talks about, quote, pro-choice politicians. Who is Susan Molinari?
Well, she's a very relatively young congresswoman from Staten Island who is repeatedly referred in the media as referred to as a pro-choice moderate, when in fact she's not exactly pro-choice and she is most certainly not a moderate. But abortion is, as you know, emerged as the dominant issue in this year's convention, and it is now a litmus test for how what the party feels about women and about for moderates versus conservative. In fact, Susan Molinari in the last Congress has voted with Newt Gingrich more than 90% of the time, which definitely puts her well into the ranks of conservatives. Women like Marge Rokema from New Jersey and Connie Morella from Maryland, who are true GOP moderates, are more in the 70-80% range of voting with Newt Gingrich. Moreover, the fact that Susan Molinari is repeatedly referred to as a moderate has largely to do with her pro-choice position. She's labeled pro-choice despite having voted most recently for the what is called the partial birth abortion ban, when in fact that is, as we know, a made-up name and is actually refers to a late-term abortion technique. And this is the part that I think is most disturbing. I know that some abortion rights activists have tried to get the media to stop referring to her as pro-choice without qualification, but with no luck.
Judy Randall, you've been following her for 7 years. You've been following Susan Molinari for the Staten Island Advance. I know you went to sleep very late, so we appreciate you getting up early and being on the phone with us. Is this a change? She clearly is not a moderate today. Where did Susan Molinari get her start?
Well, first let me just say that I'm not here to either thump Susan Molinari or trumpet her, and I'll leave it up to viewers and listeners to decide whether or not she should be called a moderate, because that's certainly not my role. I think she would probably consider herself pro-choice, she opposes the late-term abortions. Of course, that's the way she voted. There's no question about it. She did, however, vote against a number of anti-abortion riders, and she still supports Medicaid funding for abortion, funding for abortions at military hospitals, which was a big issue. So, I mean, she could certainly articulate her views on that issue better than I, but I think she still considers herself pro-choice. She has voted, as the other reporter just noted from The Voice, something like 92% with Newt Gingrich. She was a supporter of the Contract with America. She's gone around the country talking about the Contract with America. There's no question that her voting record, certainly this session, is conservative. She's a supporter of the Contract with America.
Well, let me give listeners some idea of her voting record here. According to Washington tabulations, she has a 10% rating out of 100 from the Americans for Democratic Action. She has a 0% rating from the AFL-CIO Committee on Political Education. She has an 8% rating from the League of Conservation Voters and an 8% rating from PeacePAC about conversion to peaceful uses. So she is well down in the single digits in most of those categories. And I should point out to listeners that a big game is being played now about who votes with Newt in Congress. There's something called the approval of the Daily Journal. It's kind of like approving the minutes when Congress opens every day. A lot of the conservative Republicans are now voting not to approve the minutes at the opening of the Congress, and you get 40 or 50 votes out of 435 who don't approve the minutes. That goes as a recorded vote against the leadership. So they can then go back home and see, I didn't vote with Newt Gingrich on X number of times, and it drives their ratings down lower.
I wanted to ask Judy Randall about that comment you just made in 1994 in the last congressional elections, which, of course, led to the GOP-dominated Congress. What about Susan Molinari going around the country, not spending much time at home because she had a pretty sure win in Staten Island, going around with her husband? Can you talk about her husband's position in the Republican Party, a Congress member from Buffalo, Tom Paxson?
It's Bill Paxson.
Bill Paxson, sorry.
Yeah, he's head of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, which is the committee that pretty much decides who's going to get funding from the Republican Party in tight GOP races around the country. In 1994, on Staten Island, her district extends into Brooklyn, too, I should add, she faced a Democrat by the name of Tyrone Butler. He got something like 25% of the vote. There was a right-to-life candidate who got maybe 3 or 4%, and she got, I think it was something like 70 or 71 or 2% of the vote in 94. She faces Tyrone Butler again, but in 94, she was pretty confident of victory, so she went around the country campaigning for Republican Party candidates in congressional districts around the country, telling people that it was important to elect a Republican majority in the House to get certain things done, like the contract with America and others. And she was pretty successful. I mean, they won a huge number of House seats, as you know, and made history by installing a Republican majority in the House.
Are she and her husband breaking the law? What's the law in New York State about whether or not you have to live in your congressional district, and where do they, in fact, live?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, the law in New York State, as you know, or I think actually,
I don't know,
according,
actually.
According to the Constitution, is that you don't have to live in the congressional district
right.
in which you run. But she lives in Staten Island. I mean, she owns a house in a community named Newdorp. It's a house with an American flag out the window and a white picket fence and the whole deal. He, I believe, owns a condominium in Buffalo. They also own a house together in Alexandria, Virginia. So during the week, I guess they sort of do a reverse commute. During the week, they live and work together in Virginia, and on the weekends she comes back to Staten Island and he goes back to Buffalo. So I don't believe there are any laws being broken at all.
Well, we know that they've seen each other at least once in the past few years because a baby was held up last night.
That's right. Well, as I said, they sort of reverse commute and they live and work together during the week. So I'm not exactly sure where the baby was conceived. I'm not sure I want to know. So
I wonder what people think here. Let me bring you back, Jennifer, into this about the use of that charming child last night on television and the number of times that we saw it being held by its father and then its grandfather, her father and then her grandfather during the speech.
I have to say I preferred looking at the baby more than anyone else.
It was actually pretty incredible there. I found myself caught in the throng of photographers, about three deep, close to 100 photographers who were gathered right in front of the row that included Elizabeth Dole, Jack Kemp, her father, Staten Island Borough President Guy Molinari, Bill Paxson, and most importantly, of course, the baby. And every time the baby lurched one way or the other or started to look like it was going to, you know, burp or drool, the entire throng of photographers also, you know, lurched accordingly and jostled for positions to get better pictures. I mean, it was undoubtedly the best photograph to be made in the entire convention hall, and every photographer knew it, and they were all being, you know, making very certain that they got it.
I was
it.
Thinking there was just one way that baby could have been photographed more on television. That is if she was African-American, since we know that, as the
right,
New York Times did that analysis today. People who have black faces are much more likely to be on TV during this GOP convention. Well, there is not only Susan Molinari, who spoke last night, and Judy Randall, I want to thank you very much for joining us at this early hour, since you stayed up all night to cover her for your afternoon paper, the Staten Island Advance. But Christine Todd Whitman also spoke last night, the New Jersey governor.
We believe in the value of the individual. We appreciate the differences that make each person unique. We know they add to the richness of American life and they add to the strength of the Republican Party. But for all our differences, whether over choice or national defense, our party is united by this goal, electing Bob Dole, the next president of the United States.
New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman speaking last night at the GOP convention. In addition to Jennifer Gonerman of The Voice, we're also joined by Adele Stan. And she wrote a profile of Christine Todd Whitman for Ms. Magazine. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the New Jersey governor, Adele?
Well, she's a complicated person. There are things about her that are very appealing and likable, especially her rhetoric on social issues and on inclusiveness, and she's pro-gay rights, she's pro-affirmative action, she's pro-choice. She sounds an awful lot like a feminist when she talks. You know, as a person, to sit in her presence, she's very, very imposing and impressive figure. But, I mean, she talks the talk, but she doesn't really walk the walk. I mean, Her commitment to choice has been, you know, where I tend to be a little bit dubious about it. I think she does believe in it, but I don't know that she'd ever go to the mat for it.
Well, we will talk about how much to the mat she went for it during the GOP platform discussions when we come back after this break. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, and we're still joined by Jennifer Goneman of The Village Voice and also Adele Stan, who did a profile of Christine Todd Whitman in Ms. Magazine. Well, let's talk about what happened with Christine Todd Whitman, the New Jersey governor, last week during the platform hearings. Jennifer, you were covering them. We have spoken about this on Democracy Now! The last week for the pro-choice community, the people that emerged as heroes, and some might be appalled to think of Governor Pete Wilson as a hero, but in the pro-choice movement last past week, he said he wanted to take the issue of abortion to a floor fight. Also, Governor William Weld said he wanted to do that, and Olympia Snowe, the Maine senator, all, of course, Republicans. Why did Christine Todd Whitman fall out of this mix?
I think that Christine Todd Whitman fell out because she basically was folded into the GOP at the last minute. She was named the temporary co-chairman of the convention, so she had a lot invested in it. She's on the convention floor all the time, and, you know, up at the podium every hour. So if she had lost her place, her role within the convention, it would have been a serious loss and real. And she would have lost that national podium, a national stage that just definitely
Pete
craves.
Wilson lost it for that.
Right.
But Pete Wilson isn't a rising star in the Republican Party as Christine Todd Whitman is. And I wanted to ask you, Adele, about Christine Todd Whitman. You said she's sort of a feminist. What kind of a feminist takes a tax action whose net effect may be cutting the pensions of women far into the future? I mean, basically, she changed the tax structure of New Jersey, or has tried to, by raiding the pension funds of future employees on the supposition that there was too much money in this pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
What do the feminist community say about that in New Jersey?
Well, I mean, we've had interesting stuff going on with the feminist community in New Jersey regarding Christine Todd Whitman. This is what I was saying, is that she talks like a feminist, and the rhetoric is very appealing. And in New Jersey, as in the New York metro area, feminist positions are good politics. And Christine Todd Whitman will be the first person to tell you that pro-choice is good politics. You cannot get elected, in New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, if you're not pro-choice. Now, certainly, her whole fiscal policy is, you know, she calls it fiscal conservatism. I call it fiscal radicalism. And most of the people who have been harmed by this whole restructuring of the tax system, so we could have an across-the-board tax credit, which is tax cut, which sounds eerily familiar.
In fact, yesterday at a press conference, one of the journalists said, "Why don't you say tell Bob Dole he should be crediting you with this, because she was the first one."
I think I said that.
That was you, Adele. You were behind
it. I asked her if it was a personal victory, which she, you know, declined to claim credit for. Really, the victory is Steve Forbes, who crafted both the Dole and the Whitman tax cut plan.
She's also the crafter of the family cap, which is being a model, used as a model around the country, isn't
it? I don't think we can call her the crafter of that.
Well, she followed through.
She followed through on Jim Florio, the Democratic governor who lost to Christie. He's the person who instituted that. And ironically, when I said there were interesting things in the feminist community in New Jersey over this, Now New Jersey, the New Jersey chapter of Now, endorsed Christine Todd Whitman for for governor because Florio had initiated the family cap. And
explain what that is.
A family cap is, in terms of welfare benefits, once you sign up for welfare, if you have any more children, they don't get the extra, what is it, $64 a month per child benefit.
And that was just held up in court this past weekend.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed
and
that.
Of course,
I'll have to check that out.
That's a controversial measure on several levels, one of which is that the anti-abortion forces are in part opposed to it because they believe that it will encourage abortion. If a person believes that another child is going to cost them money, they may get rid
sure.
of the child.
Sure, and of course the Roman Catholic Church is very much
right.
against it.
Let me ask both of you a question in talking about feminism here. Somebody who's been pushed back into the closet, as it were, over the past few months is Hillary Rodham Clinton. Mm-hmm. We have the Democratic convention coming up. Here the Republicans are making a huge effort to have, as you said, Jennifer, Christine Todd Whitman up there. Every time I look at the screen, she's on the stage the last couple of nights. And many other women, including Susan Molinari, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, women from Congress, et cetera, constantly on the screen, at least on C-SPAN. I don't know if they make it on the networks. What about Hillary Rodham Clinton? There's a person who is identified by the right-wing forces as the arch-devil feminist. What are the Democrats going to do with this, and what is it going to say?
That's a really tough question to answer. I mean, it poses a very serious problem for the Democrats, what they're going to do with Hillary, how they're going to handle the issue. Obviously, she has a tremendous amount of appeal, especially for younger women, professional women, who see her as a role model, so they wouldn't, of course, want to hide her. On the other hand, I'm sure we won't be seeing her get maximum exposure. She certainly won't be playing the kind of role that Liddy Dole's playing out here in
yeah.
San Diego.
You know, we were all yesterday at a Republican Women's Leadership Summit, Jennifer and Adele, and they were parading the women who are leaving Congress, like Kansas Senator Nancy Kassebaum, for example. But one of the things that Elizabeth Dole said, and this was quite surprising, and I think she really speaks to, tailors her speeches, she talked about women having power, and she said, "We're going to take control."
Right.
My goodness, it's something that I would have thought she would have characterized Hillary Rodham Clinton saying.
Right.
I never thought I'd hear it from Elizabeth Dole.
Well, and I don't think you would have heard her saying that from a podium in New Hampshire in February. I felt that it was very striking too. All of the her talk, she kept talking about how much things have changed and how she was discriminated against when she worked in the White House years ago, and yet she's anti-choice and there seems to be this sort of, while you're demonizing feminism, you hear a lot of this, well, look at how far we've come. Well, who opened those doors?
In fact, Elizabeth Dole told a story of how she was discriminated
right.
against, and she was prepared. She was a cabinet member prepared for a meeting, and they wouldn't let her into the building. They said, no women here.
Did anybody mention the fact that there are fewer women delegates here by a significant percentage than there were 4 years ago, from 46% to 33%?
That's actually something that I included in the story that's running in the Village Voice this week. Back in the early 80s, the Republican Party was actually the first party to try and push the issue, Republican feminists pushed the issue of 50-50 male-female delegates, and they passed not a requirement but sort of a recommendation that happened. The numbers jacked up to the 40s. They were into the mid-40s in the 80s and in 1992, and then significantly dropped this year to 33%. And the deceptive thing about the television coverage is, of course, you see women on the screen so often, you have no idea that there's such a low number in the convention hall this year.
Jennifer Geimerman, you've also been talking about the gender gap. You're not the only one, but give us your take on it.
The gender gap is posing a very, very problematic situation for the GOP this year, which is why we're seeing so many women. And at the same time, you've got all of these conservative, very conservative members of the GOP, particularly very conservative women, who are saying the gender gap is no big deal. Yesterday at a Phyllis Schlafly pro-life event at SeaWorld, no less.
You do get around, don't you?
I've been running around.
Had a whale of a time.
I had a whale of a time, I have to say. And Beverly LeHay was up there at the podium saying the gender gap does not exist. It's not a problem.
She's of Concerned Women of America.
That's exactly right. And she is very conservative. And so there's definitely a bit of a balancing act that the Dole campaign has to do to sort of appeal to these voters and not anger the very conservative women.
But what they're trying to do to appeal to them is the tax cut. They hit this over and over and over again. We'll put more money in your pocket. Is that going to work, Adele?
Well, I don't think so. I think that they might have had a shot at narrowing that gap a little bit if you know, Kemp is an appealing figure despite the fact that he's anti-choice because he's pro-affirmative action, and I think
well, he was.
Exactly. This is my point. And I think that, you know, a lot of times when we're looking at quote-unquote women's issues, we fixate on abortion and don't recognize that affirmative action, you know, white middle-class women are the number one beneficiaries of affirmative action. Now, with Kemp having done this about-face on affirmative action, you know, I think that they have underestimated how important that issue is to women.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And at the end of this hour, we're going to be talking about Jack Kemp's record and the fact that he called Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum the most powerful lobbying force in America today. Jennifer Gonerman of The Voice, Adele Stan of Ms. Magazine, thank you very much for joining us, talking about Susan Molinari, the keynote speaker last night, New York Congressmember, and Christine Todd Whitman, New Jersey governor and co-chair of the Republican Convention. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up in the second hour of Democracy Now!, AFL-CIO leader Rich Trumka talks party politics and workers' rights, a look at African Americans in the GOP, and a conversation with Alexander Coburn. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and Larry Bensky's just stepped out, and Juan Gonzalez is rejoining us. I'm Amy Goodman, and in the last few days, there has been a lot of noise, particularly from the protest pen, as we call it, two railroad tracks and many fences away from the convention. A lot of noise about the money that's going into this convention. In fact, the American Lung Association, American Cancer Society have been there, and they have been protesting Philip Morris's efforts to defeat proposed FDA regulations on tobacco marketing to kids. And they're pouring money into the Republican Party, as well as what they're going to be doing at the Democratic Convention in the next few weeks. And 2 days ago, there was a protest in the Penn. All of these people came, as well as an interesting figure, someone we haven't heard about very much lately, but who certainly was a significant figure on the right-wing talk show circuit. And he is Morton Downey Jr. He was there to talk about his own experience. He was a heavy smoker until he got lung cancer, and he talked about why he's now protesting.
I'm here to express the point of view of a lot of the people with the American Lung Association that the tobacco companies are addicting our youth. And I'm a pretty good example of a guy who was stupid enough to buy my own hype for years and smoke like a fiend.
What happened to you?
I got lung cancer.
And what?
3 weeks ago, they cut my lung out.
When?
My right one. 3 weeks ago, yesterday.
How are you doing now?
I'm doing great. I'm just one of those lucky guys, you know. I'm just lucky. I mean, my own family said, yeah, probably the best thing that ever happened to me was getting lung cancer because I finally got rid of the dirty, filthy cigarettes.
How much did you smoke?
Depending on whether I had a rough television show or an easy television show. Rough one, I'd smoke 5 packs a day. An easy one, that was a 3-packer.
Have you stopped?
Oh, have I stopped smoking? You bet your life. Yeah. Has the Pope stopped necking with girls?
You are on the board of the National Smokers Alliance.
I was
what
on
is
the
that?
Board of directors. National Smokers Alliance is supposedly a grassroots organization with over 4 million members who are there to scare the living hell out of the Congress of the United States to support their right to never have to tell anyone what goes in their product.
And is it actually industry sponsored?
Totally.
How do you know?
I was on the board of directors, my dear lady. All right, I assure you, it was totally sponsored. The major sponsor was Philip Morris.
How did they communicate with you?
They didn't communicate with us. They communicated with the executive director. The executive director communicated with the 32 members of the board of directors. And all they were using were famous names so that they could hype it up. Pierre Solinger, and Andre Morgan, Morton Downey Jr., a lot of industry people. So that, you could hype it up.
And what specifically did you do? Did you work on particular initiatives to prevent legislation?
I went to the first 3 meetings and realized it was a phony front and stopped going to meetings. And a year later resigned. That's what I did.
You said in your speech that you have tapes of the meetings.
I do.
What do they say at the meetings?
Every meeting. Well, you know what? I would have revealed it up there if I was about to reveal it. And I didn't.
So what do you plan to do now about having been a member, having promoted this?
I plan on being in as many functions as I can to help youngsters not get involved and let them know they're not going to live to be 1,327,000 years of age. And they might as well get a hold of their life now.
So you've said why you're against the cigarette companies, but what about the Republican convention? Why do this here?
Well, this is where the cigarette companies are wielding a lot of influence, right here at this convention. And they'll wield a lot of influence at the Democratic one, and I'll be at the Democratic one also.
Are you a Republican?
I am. I am a registered Republican.
Morton Downey Jr., yes, remember him, and he was one of the few talk show hosts who would smoke on television. You heard he smokes 3 to 5 packs a day. He smoked until he had his lung cut out 3 weeks ago.
Well, it's amazing the Republican Party had the born-again welfare queen speaking, but not Morton Downey, a longtime Republican, speaking about his conversion.
Well, he was not the only one there. And joining us right now are Deborah Kelly, Vice President of the American Lung Association of San Diego, and Ed Gillette, a volunteer with the ALA, the American Lung Association. He's also a former smoker and suffers from emphysema and is a lung disease patient. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Can you tell us about what has been going on here in San Diego, Deborah Kelly? You've been having a battle over the last few months.
Yeah, I think we're sort of engaged in a cat-and-mouse game with the tobacco industry. And unfortunately, they have the characteristics of a Cheshire cat because they seem to be able to become invisible when they want. They come into the political process, and they want a lot of visibility when it comes to elected officials and people who can influence public policy. But when it comes to letting the American public know what they're doing, then they choose to become invisible. And we have been tracking the events that that Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds and the other tobacco companies have been sponsoring. We have been having a presence at those events to communicate our message that nicotine is a drug, we need to protect our kids by regulating the tobacco industry.
You've also had a battle with the art museum here, the San Diego Museum of Art. They told you a couple months ago when you all raised quite a furor over the fact that Philip Morris was going to be sponsoring events there during the convention. They told you, okay, after the furor, we won't do it, and Philip Morris made the same announcement on May 1st. But it seems that that all changed this week.
Yeah, it's amazing what enough money will do. The Museum of Art told us that they did not know that Philip Morris would be using their facilities, that this was all set up by the San Diego Host Committee. Quite frankly, we told them that we didn't think that was a very credible explanation, and we thought that what had really happened is they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to have the money from Philip Morris, and they wanted to be able to enjoy the acclamations that they were getting from the community for having the courage to say no to Philip Morris. But whoever was responsible, whether it was the Museum of Art or the San Diego Host Committee, the message had been clearly communicated by the community that we didn't want Philip Morris there. Philip Morris is dirty money. It's tainted money. These events, these very deluxe events, are paid for with the lives of Americans
well,
who are dying from tobacco
you went
use.
To the Museum of Art when the Georgia delegation, we didn't see Newt Gingrich there, but the rest of the Georgia delegation with Senator Coverdale came for their party. You were outside protesting, and you were kept away from the museum, a public space. I went up to the door and asked the spokesperson for the Museum of Art, Marty Snow, why the museum was allowing Philip Morris to use that public space.
This is an RNC event. I have no comment.
But why are you here if it has nothing to do with the museum and your PR for the museum?
No answer, so I continue to ask
did
questions.
Tell the community that you wouldn't be doing this, and then today turned around in the San Diego Union Tribune. It's the first time they found out this was happening. Did the museum have absolutely no dealings with Philip Morris, never talked to them, only talked to the RNC, and had nothing to do with this? And how much money did the museum receive from Philip Morris for this event? The group of people out there have emphysema, lung cancer, and some of their loved ones died of smoking-related diseases. Any comment on these, your neighbors in San Diego? Marty Snow?
Hi there. Welcome to the museum.
Here with the Georgia delegation?
Well, we're not members of the Georgia delegation, but we're friends of all.
Ms. Snow, if this has nothing to do with the museum, why are you welcoming people? And so she called the police.
If they want you here, they'll invite you. If they don't want you here, they didn't invite you. It's a closed event. No public is allowed. You are public, okay? Your press pass doesn't allow you to go anywhere you want, right? We have security concerns and lots of other concerns. You need to walk out to the public area.
And as the police brought me over to the side where the protesters were, they started to chant. They started to chant Philip against Philip Morris.
No. Philip Morris, no!
And as they chanted, the Republicans brought the mariachi band out to drown them out. And interestingly enough, the mariachi band, maybe they understood, started playing Love Story, which is the theme song of the movie about a young woman who dies of cancer. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll continue our discussion of tobacco with our guests and Ed Mierzwinski of U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Deborah Kelly of the American Lung Association here in San Diego, Ed Gillette, a volunteer there, and also a man who suffers from emphysema for smoking himself. Ed, I noticed you during the protest in the day and at night because as everyone was chanting, Philip Morris, no, we don't want your murderous dough, you were clapping.
Well, my wind isn't that good. I tried that chant thing, but it just didn't work, so I started clapping my hands to get involved with the group I was with. But I couldn't. My breath wasn't good enough for
me. Why do you suffer from lung disease?
I smoked for 45 years, and I was diagnosed with emphysema about 10 years ago. I'm operating now with about 50% of my lung capacity. And I'm not complaining. Nobody put a cigarette in my mouth and made me do it. But I am a little bit upset with the tobacco industry because they never let us know what it was doing to us. I had no idea until the fellow who was supposed to be partially brainwashed came out with the Surgeon General's warning. I didn't pay attention to it, obviously, but that was the first glimmering I ever had that it was a fatal addiction.
And well, Ed Gillette, precisely yeah. The argument of the tobacco companies is that this is a matter of individual choice. People create their own destiny by deciding whether to smoke or not. But interestingly enough, in Jacksonville, Florida, I know you are probably aware of the decision in the court case that occurred last week where a man by the name of Grady Carter, who has lung cancer and had smoked most of his life, and admitted that even though the members of his family, his wife, advised him against it, he continued to smoke. Yet a jury found the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company guilty in this lawsuit, and precisely because of the documents that have come forth in recent years, internal company documents where the companies had clearly knew the addictive nature of cigarette tobacco, but did not advise the public and continued to defy that. What's your sense now in terms of the responsibility of the companies in this area?
Well, I think that had I have had the knowledge that people have now, I would not have smoked to the extent that I did. I'm upset with the idea that this is people that are smoking now, adults that are smoking now, they're not smoking because they want to smoke. They're smoking because they have to smoke. They have a nicotine level in their blood, which has been supplied by the tobacco companies, and they can't quit. I handle many, many phone calls every week at the American Lung Association. I have people call with a lung missing on oxygen and can't quit smoking. And that's not because they want to smoke.
Ed Gillette, we're joined now by a man who has been studying how much money the corporations, the cigarette corporations, have been pouring into the Democratic and Republican Party. I want to comment on your T-shirts. Ed, you're wearing a T-shirt that says, "Leave the pack behind." I think it's a play on both the cigarette pack and packs. And also, Debbie, you're wearing a T-shirt, "Protect the Kids, Not the Tobacco Industry," both T-shirts that were at these protests. Ed Mrzewinski of USPIRG, how much money are we talking about here?
Amy, we're talking about so much money, it's really incalculable, but just today it's reported in the Washington Post that the top soft money contributors to the Republicans, the number one contributor, Philip Morris, at $1.6 million in the last 18 months, number two, RJR, at $970,000, and number five is U.S. Tobacco. That's in addition, of course, soft money to direct campaign contributions, and doesn't even consider the vast sums of money that they spend in the states and in the convention process. In California 2 years ago, Philip Morris had a secret initiative that they were secretly funding. They spent nearly $20 million to try to roll back tough tobacco restrictions. It's unbelievable how much money these guys have spent.
Well, Ed Mrzewinski, the companies may have a little bit less money to spend now because as a result of this Jacksonville suit, apparently Philip Morris's stock dropped from Friday to today 15% in value, and the whole tobacco industry is reeling from this court decision. Do you think that this may be the opening of various court decisions around the country in favor of victims of tobacco? Because up until this time, the companies have prevailed in the courts.
Well, just like your guests, I certainly hope so, because I think it's a very encouraging decision. But one thing that is, I think, more significant in the news today is that the Food and Drug Administration has sent its final rule up to the president on preventing tobacco addiction to kids. And that's what the industry is really scared about, is the FDA, Dr. David Kessler, and the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, the American Lung Association, the Cancer Society, and all of the groups that are fighting to stop this pediatric disease. And that's why they've given so much money to Congress to try to roll back the FDA's rule. So in the short run, I think they're very concerned about the FDA. In the long run, I hope we can win more and more lawsuits against them.
Ed, do you know what those FDA rules are now, what they have handed down?
They're supposed to be very similar to the proposed rule from last year, and they will ban most advertising that targets children. 95% of all smokers start by the age of 18, and the industry is lying when it says that its real business is selling to adults who make a choice. Their real business is addicting children. Just as they addict our politicians with Camel Cash, they addict children first by seducing them with the imagery of Joe Camel, and then, of course, nicotine, the addictive drug in their product.
Deborah Kelly, how many kids start smoking every day?
About 3,000. The tobacco industry turns about 3,000 kids into nicotine addicts each day.
I want to say that I called Philip Morris yesterday. They are staying a whole contingent at the DoubleTree Hotel, a very fancy hotel here in San Diego. And they said they wouldn't come on, the first person I spoke to. I said, well, would any of the other spokespeople come on? And she said no. I asked her about the protest you had yesterday, because you guys just don't stop at the American Lung Association outside the Texas delegation, right? They were being feted by Philip Morris. And she said, I didn't know of any protest. What happened there?
Oh, they certainly knew about it. In fact, she was present. We were lucky because we had a very visible area, and they ended up closing the curtain so these people could not see outside. We sort of spoiled the view, I suppose, for them. But the other thing that happened was they asked that the police be dispatched. They sent over the security guards. They told us we were not allowed to protest in this public area, and we said that was not our understanding. And they threatened us by calling the police, and we said we would welcome the police. And the police came and said, it is your right to stay here and protest, and that's not a problem.
Philip Morris said they didn't call the police, so it remains to be seen who exactly did. But they did say you have a right to protest, but they too have a right. Ed Mrzewinski, what do you say about that right of the tobacco interests?
I don't think they've got any rights. They're selling a drug that they target to children, and I think the Congress and the state legislatures and the FDA need to take tough actions against them. I don't think they should be advertising in Sports Illustrated, for example. The magazine is primarily read by children, or largely read by children. I don't think they should be marketing at sports events. And I don't think they should be giving away gimmicks through magazines that all you have to do is sign a piece of paper that says, I am a smoker, I am 21 years old. They should be restricted to marketing with tombstone advertisements, and they should be limited in the product giveaways that they use. Again, I cannot stress, their goal is totally addicting children, and everything they say, all of the lawyers and politicians that they buy, is designed to hide the fact that all they're trying to do is addict kids.
Ed Mrzewinski, I want to thank you very much for joining us, as well as Deborah Kelly and Ed Gillette of the American Lung Association. Ed Mrzewinski, a number for people to get your reports out of U.S. PIRG.
Well, U.S. PIRG's number is 202-546-9707. Our reports are also on the Internet, www.pirg.org.
And I also want to say that the number for the American Lung Association is 1-800-LUNG-USA. That's 1-800-LUNG-USA. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're going to move on to another subject right now, and that is the subject of Jack Kemp. The Republican Party has been trying to portray a more moderate image of itself this year. The tightly scripted TV spectacle, really a thing, a primetime infomercial for the party, is designed to wipe out the memory of the 92 Houston Convention, where a parade of Christian right leaders, from Pat Robertson to Pat Buchanan to Marilyn Quayle, dominated with hot right-wing rhetoric from the podium, rhetoric declaring an all-out war for the soul of America. Even though Pat Buchanan's not speaking this year, it's been abundantly clear this week that the Christian right is still in control of the Republican Party. We're joined now by Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, has come back, and Mike Hudson, Western Director for People for the American Way. What is Jack Kemp's record with the Christian right?
Well, it's not widely known, but not widely portrayed here in San Diego, but Jack Kemp has had a long and distinguished record with the religious right, going back to 1988 especially. He was really not a darling of this movement then when he ran for president, but he went out and courted the movement heavily. He appointed Beverly and Tim LaHaye. Bev LaHaye runs the Concerned Women for America, who both started here in San Diego at Shadow Mountain Church. Leaders of the religious right as a part of his national campaign chairs, and they were later fired because of their anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic views. He has an absolutely complete record voting against everything in terms of women's health, choice, reproductive freedom. It's funny, Ralph Reed was actually a Jack Kemp delegate before he even got to know Pat Robertson. So it goes back a long ways, and there's no doubt that this nomination was cleared by the Christian Coalition before it was made here.
Does Jack Kemp believe in anything? I mean, here we see, we've been talking about it already this morning on this show and yesterday, that he has backed off on affirmative action. Now today's Los Angeles Times has a headline story that he's backed off on his opposition to Prop 187 as well. Does he believe in anything?
I think he's flexible, what I would say. He obviously is a politician.
Well, is he flexible or is he totally unprincipled in your judgment?
Well, I guess that's sort of a subjective thing. I think he's having to get in line with the Dole Republican Party campaign, and it's controlled. You said earlier it's still controlled by the religious right. It's more controlled by the religious right in 1996 than it was in 1992, 94. There are really two conventions going on here. It's the sort of Fantasy Island show that's on television for the American public, and then exactly. There's the real convention that happened all last week during the platform, and everything is being dominated by the Christian right.
I wonder if you can legally change your name now, if he could, maybe to Dole. I mean, it's still a four-letter word. That's as Dole says. Let's remember. He said it's the two four-letter words you can teach your kids, Dole and Kemp.
Yeah. Mike, you've been monitoring the religious right in the Western states for People for the American Way for some time now. Is there a change in their tactic from the so-called stealth candidacies that they had here in Southern California for a while, where they hid who they were, to now being out front, proud, and bearing the standard of the Christian right?
Well, sort of, but this is really a stealth convention that's going on here, in a stealth campaign. It's gone from stealth at the grassroots to stealth at the national level. What you're seeing on television the last 2 days is not what's going on here in San Diego. It's not a picture of who controls the Republican Party. So they've got a stealth convention going on. I think they've taken it to a new level, and they walk both sides of the street. Sometimes they want to flex their muscle, and they showed Bob Dole, who was boss here last week, very visibly beating him on everything around the platform. Now they've sort of gone underground, and they're using their lobbying effort on the floor to keep the delegates quiet when these moderates are getting up there talking.
What's been the impact of the religious right out here in the West in terms of the African American and Latino communities in terms of making inroads? I know around some school issues, there were many school boards that were attempting to gain control years back. What's been the impact there?
Well, I think they are clearly reaching out. They recognize that they could not be a majority force just with their numbers of their membership, so they had to reach out and pull in other folks. So they've used wedge issues, beginning with the New York school board elections a couple of years ago, to reach out to the African American and the Latino community, and they're making some inroads, especially this church burning thing. That was really a big boon for them, to try to hook up with the black ministers and supposedly raise money. I've never seen a dollar of it, but to raise money to rebuild the churches. So they're clearly reaching out to those two communities. I don't know that it's caught on particularly well out here in the West.
What about in the races for Congress? The Christian right is increasingly proud of, and some of the candidates that have been identified with them say that they are proud of being backed by the Christian right. Do you think that peaked in 1994? I know People for the American Way surveys things, as we do, district by district. What do you think?
I think it remains to be seen whether it peaked in 94. Clearly, they had a great deal of influence, claimed something like 25 or 26 districts that they were swinging in 94. The question between now and November, starting on Friday of this week, is the support, visible support of the religious right, going to be a positive or a negative for congressional candidates? And I just don't know yet. I think I think the big challenge is for those of us in the moderate world to make sure that the public knows about not only the support of the Christian right, but what their dangerous agenda is.
The moderate world. I like that phrase.
Mike Hudson, what about the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum? Last night, actually, we didn't talk about it at the beginning of the show, but she was walking out rather quickly after New York Congressmember Susan Molinari's speech. She clearly doesn't agree with her on the issue of choice and many other things.
Which Molinari, of course, didn't mention.
That's right. But what about Jack Kemp and Phyllis Schlafly? What's their relationship?
Well, Phyllis was a Jack Kemp delegate in 1988 as well, along with the other folks. So they've got a very close relationship. I actually was in the Phyllis Schlafly anti-choice rally out at SeaWorld yesterday, paid my $85 as a participant there, and I thought that's where the real convention was going on, not on the floor in front of the TV camera. There was much more reality to that convention out there, 1,000 folks. With all of them, Pat Buchanan, Pat Robertson, Alan Keyes, the whole group out there. And that celebration was a lot more indicative of what I think is going on in the party than what was going on television.
What were they doing?
They were celebrating.
They're schmoozing?
No. It was a celebration of the winning everything that they wanted in the platform, and giving each other awards for their efforts to keep any kind of reproductive choice out of the Republican platform.
To what degree do you think the mass media, especially the television networks, have been falling for this this game of what is the advertised convention versus the real convention? Has there been any systematic or clear attempts by especially the television coverage, to pierce through this?
Not much. It's really ironic that for 3 or 4 days solid, they covered the right-wing domination and the moderates losing out. And it was just like all of a sudden they completely switched and covered this this canned thing that's been on the last 2 days.
Mike, let me ask you this. If People for the American Way is to be an effective counter to any of this, you basically have to do the same kind of grassroots organizing, and so do other groups that believe in something different, as the Christian right is doing.
Absolutely.
How's that going? Because we don't see People for the American Way identified candidates, for example, standing up in Democratic Party primaries and saying, I believe what People for the American Way are saying, et cetera.
No, we're not quite there yet. As a matter of fact, I think that is the big challenge. I think we have to keep in mind that everything that you may disagree with the right, and be worried about their agenda. But what they've done in terms of mobilizing voters is absolutely commendable, and we have to get out there and compete if we're going to really make a difference. That's the, we got to win this the old-fashioned way by mobilizing progressive voters.
But you don't have churches, you don't have tax-free television channels, you don't have all of the ammunition that the Christian right has used over the years.
Well, we have a bunch of mainline churches if we can get them mobilized as well. So it's a matter of getting going, and we're barely scratching the surface right now, frankly.
Well, Mike Hudson, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Mike Hudson, Western Director for People for the American Way, talking about Jack Kemp and his connection to the Christian right. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and engineered by Michael Yoshida. Thanks very much to Mark Beavis in Washington. Our convention team includes Bill Wax, Kathy Still, Larry Bensky, and Juan Gonzalez. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And tomorrow in our first hour, we'll be talking with Chuck Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity, talking about the money trail. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for a special edition of Democracy Now! From San Diego. From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now!
We will have died and gone to heaven. It'll be nirvana when we have both parties clamoring to support working people's issues. Now, why stay with the Democrats? I think historically the Democratic Party has represented workers, and we will yet to see in the near future whether they will continue to. I think right now workers are assessing that. Workers are saying, is this the party that represents workers? And I think the vast majority of the Democratic leadership on the House side and the Senate side would very easily pass that test.
Labor finds few friends here in the GOP. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Rich Trumka crashes the party to talk about workers' rights and the 96 elections. Can African Americans find a home in the grand old party? A lifelong Republican says yes, but a new report finds there are fewer blacks at this convention than there were 4 years ago. And Alexander Coburn and a spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee drop by to tell us what they've been up to here in San Diego. All that and more coming up on this special convention edition of Democracy Now! And welcome to our second hour of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, will be joining us in our next segment with Alexander Coburn. Organized labor has been the brunt of fierce attacks by the Republican Party in this election year, in part because the AFL-CIO gave a historic early endorsement of incumbent President Bill Clinton, and the Federation is spending tens of millions of dollars to get him reelected. This week in San Diego, the AFL-CIO's presence is mostly felt on the outside of the convention. Richard Trumka has stopped by. He's Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO and former president of the United Mine Workers. Why are you here?
I'm here to make sure that working persons' issues are aired out, that they become part of the debate. We were afraid that inside the convention that probably wouldn't happen, so we're here to make sure that outside the convention, at least, issues that are important to working people get raised.
Like?
Well, Social Security, Medicare, student loans, minimum wage, collective bargaining for workers, those type of issues, health and safety issues on the job, repetitive motion things, all of the things that affect our health and safety and our well-being. The two issues I think that are on American workers' mind the most today, I think, are one, the wage gap. Our wages have stagnated over the years. A high school graduate, a female high school graduate right now will earn 18% less, and a male high school graduate will earn 33% less than a high school graduate did in 1978. We've gone through 5 different strategies during the 80s to combat the effects of supply-side economics. One, we started working more hours on the job. When that didn't keep pace for us, we then took on a second or a third job. When that didn't keep pace, we sent somebody else out into the workforce, a second wage earner into the workforce, sometimes a third wage earner. When that didn't keep pace, we then started incurring more debt. And when that didn't keep pace, we saw a new phenomena that we would refer to as boomeranging, where young adults are moving back home with their parents because they can't afford to live out there. All of those things are what we're facing right now, and we want those addressed in the 1996 election.
Well, Richard, one of the biggest victories, I guess, for organized labor during the Clinton administration has been the minimum wage bill. But some would say that the Republicans were able to exact from the Clinton administration enough compromises, for instance, a series of reductions in taxes and benefits for small businesses to make up for the money that they'd have to pay workers above the current minimum wage, the reduction of the elimination of tax exemptions in Puerto Rico to pay for that. Do you think that was the victory a critical or key one for you? Do you think that even in the process of getting it, that a lot was sacrificed?
I think what that fight did was demonstrate the difference between the two parties. It served to define who they stood for and what they stood for. Look, what we believe in is American workers and the American country should reward work. Workers shouldn't be out there working every day of the week, every week of the month, every month of the year, and only earn half of what it takes to get you out of the poverty level. So we said that America needs a raise, and it started with the minimum wage, so that we can start rewarding work again. We forced a group, the Gingrich Republicans, to do something they vowed they would never do, and that's increase the minimum wage. We're successful in doing that. I don't think that was a victory for Democrats. I think that was a victory for workers, for working Americans.
When you say that minimum wage defined the differences between the two parties, on NAFTA and on what's happening with free trade, it took Pat Buchanan in this election campaign to actually begin to raise the issue for, well, I think Bob Dole said, I didn't realize that the economy and jobs were going to be such a big issue in this campaign.
I think
put
Bob,
both the Democratic Party and the Republicans on the defensive.
I think Bob Dole will hear that again. And we're happy to have our issues raised from anybody. Unfortunately, Pat Buchanan, while he raised the issue, he sort of would have built a wall up around the country. He'd bash corporations that send stuff overseas, but then when they were in the country, he'd let them do anything that they wanted. I think the American worker right now sees corporate America as too strong, too powerful. There needs to be some balance. That's what we want to do. We want to have that part of the debate so that whenever you come up and you say, we want to get increased tax breaks for corporations that go overseas, and an American worker says, no, you shouldn't. You ought to create tax breaks for those that create jobs, good-paying jobs here. That's good for our communities. That's good for the country.
What about your position on NAFTA, the North American Free Trade
Agreement? We were right when we were arguing it, and we were right now. We said it was a bad deal. We didn't want a wall built up around the U.S. We want trade, but we want fair trade that benefits the country. We said that at that time that it would cost us jobs. We said that it would not increase the it would be detrimental to us on trade and it would not help the Mexican workers. Here's the facts. Since that trade agreement was negotiated, we had a positive balance of trade has gone $10 billion negative with Mexico. The Mexican workers' average wage has gone from $2.61 an hour to $1.80 an hour, and we've lost 325,000 jobs. It's exactly as we predicted.
Given those arguments, why the early Clinton endorsement? Given those arguments, why the early Clinton endorsement?
Well, that was sort of an odd argument, wasn't it? I mean, you had the Republican Party on one side pushing NAFTA, and you had the president who agreed with it on the other side, so it's sort of like a wash issue in this election, except for members of the House and things of that sort.
When you he had to pay for some of those votes because, in fact, it was very close.
Well, he did. I mean, it wasn't an easy sell because everybody thought it was a bad deal. But when you look at, you ask me why the early endorsement, well, one reason is because workers are suffering like they never suffered before. We really took a pacing in the 80s. As I said, working more hours, not getting by. And when we look at the visions of the two people, when we look at Bob Dole's vision of America and we look at Bill Clinton's vision of America, although Bill Clinton's isn't identical to ours, it's a whole lot closer for working Americans. I mean, he supported us on the minimum wage. He defended Medicare and Medicaid against cuts that the Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich wanted to impose. He defends Social Security, worker health, place safety. Look what he did just last week, pension raids. He stopped the Republicans from allowing corporations to raid our pension funds, which is a significant issue to people. Last week, he issued a new set of regulations with 401ks. I bet most Americans didn't know this. They used to take our money out of our paycheck in a 401k, and corporations would use it for 120 days, 90 or 120 days. Interest-free loan. Well, last week, the Department of Labor said you can't do that anymore, that when you take it out of a worker's paycheck, you must have it in their 401k within 15 days. That's good policy. Now, a lot of Republicans squealed about that. And they said that they shouldn't happen. But why should any corporation take my money and use it free for 120 days?
Well, Richard, almost all of the leadership of the organized labor movement is Democratic at this point, or at least is supporting the president. Yet you have the situation where for several elections now, a significant proportion of the rank and file of the labor movement, as many as 25-30%,
that's correct,
have voted Republican.
That's right.
Does this mean that the rank and file is not in touch with the leadership, or the message is not getting back to the rank and file? What's going on? Why the difference?
Well, you ask a whole lot of good questions. Yeah, there was probably 25-30% that didn't vote in the way that we thought that they should vote in the past, that voted Republican or voted for some Democrats that we didn't think that they should, in fact. First of all, Reagan won by 58%. That was a major landslide, right? So when 75 or 80% of our members vote, you know, the way that we would like to see them vote because of economics, because of what's good for them, that's pretty significant. But there's still 25, as you said, to 30%. Now, we need to address them, and that's what our program is about right now. The new program we have out is an issue-oriented program. It doesn't support either party. It's not a Democrat or a Republican party. It says, here's issues that you've told us. We went to our members and we said, what do you want us to do? And they said to us, don't tell us who to vote for. We said, okay, that's fair enough. What do you think we ought to do? They said, tell us about issues that are important to us. We said, fair enough. We went back to them again and said, what are those issues? And they gave us a list of probably 30 issues that they want us to tell them about. Where the politicians, where the different people that are running stand on those issues. And it starts with minimum wage, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, student loans, workplace health and safety, pension issues, all of the things that are important, collective bargaining issues, all of those. They said, tell us about those. That's what we're doing now. We're giving them information on those issues. We let them make the decision. We think the more informed they are, the more likely they will be to come out and vote, and we think that's good for the country. The more workers participate in the electoral process, and I don't care really how they vote. In fact, we will probably have a major celebration the day that we have the Democrats and the Republicans both fighting over who will get to introduce issues or bills that are good for workers. That's the day that we'll think that we've died and gone to heaven.
Under your new administration with John Sweeney and Linda Chavez-Thompson now, you've got a situation where you've earmarked $35 million that has the Republican Party up in arms and scared to death for the first time in a long time in terms of the impact of the labor movement. What's this war chest meant to do?
Well, they should be scared to death because for the first time, we're not going to let them vote in the dark anymore. Here's what's happened in the past, and most American workers out there will, this will sound familiar to them. They elect somebody who makes all these promises to them. They go to Washington, D.C., or they go to the state capitol, and they vote against their interest. Then they come back the next time, and they have these 30-second sound bites. They want you to believe that they're your friend, but when they get a chance to vote for you, they vote against you. So here's what we're going to do. First of all, you have to understand this. We get outspent by the independent business group, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce. We get outspent 5-1. They spend 5 times more than we could ever hope to spend. Our program is totally issue-oriented. We're spending about $20 million of that money on ads on issues that describe issues, how people voted on each one of those issues. We're going to spend another bunch of that money on voter registration and the rest of it on get out the vote to try to get as many workers as we can to participate in the electoral process in 1996. Our goal is that everybody who runs in 96 talks about workers' issues and where they stand on them. And then there's a second phase to the program. We want to create in every congressional district out there a committee of at least 100 activists that will stay in place between elections. They will then educate American workers out there on how the federal candidates, state candidates, and local candidates are voting in that two-year period so that next election year, if you've voted for workers and you're a Republican or a Democrat, we will have helped you. If you voted against the interest of workers, Democrat or Republican, we will have made it less likely for you to get elected and be able to do it again.
So you're in essence trying to set up a separate labor political structure that functions on a not just at election time, but over a period of time. How does that differ to a large degree, for instance, from the oil, chemical, and atomic workers and those who advocate a labor party or a separate labor or an independent labor organization in politics?
Well, in some instances, it's the same because what they're talking about right now, the LPA, Labor Party advocates, is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They are talking about issues that are important to working people. They endorse no candidates. Ultimately, I think they want to create a third party. A party, or they would call it whatever it would be called, Labor Party or whatever.
That's what they're calling it.
Yeah, well, okay. So they want to create a third party, although they're not endorsing candidates right now. So to the extent that they're educating on the issues, they're probably the same. The difference is we want to become totally independent and speak on behalf of workers and get both, all if there's three parties or four parties, all four of those parties to support worker issues. Mm-hmm. Now, if they won't, then if none of the parties will, then our design right now is to solicit candidates to run in primaries, in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary, so that they will have, we will have somebody to vote for that will support our issues.
We're talking to Richard Trumka, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. And by the way, when you hear McNeil Lehrer's theme in the background, it's because we're right next door to them here in the Marriott Hotel next door to the San Diego Republican Convention. So, for God's sakes, don't get confused. But you are not only one of the highest level officers in the AFL-CIO, you used to be head of the United Mine Workers.
I did.
United Mine Workers did support the Labor Party. Why didn't John Sweeney address the Labor Party in Detroit at its founding convention? He, after all, was in Detroit at the time.
Well, John was scared. He did have a schedule conflict the day that he was in town. And you have to understand, we work for a federation. We operate for a federation. We're the officers of a federation, and we don't have the luxury of making policy without going before all 78 or 80 unions that are in the federation. There has been no policy by those 78 unions, and until they do, John simply couldn't go out on his own. Regardless of where he might have thought personally, he couldn't be out there because the federation has not said that yet.
But couldn't he address them? I mean, it's not saying that we endorse you, or and then that would be my next question.
Well, he probably could have addressed them. He could have talked a lot about them. I don't know the circumstances of whether he really was invited to address them or not.
Why not leave the Democratic Party now? I mean, when you look at what they've done around NAFTA, you look at welfare repeal, what they call welfare reform, what is keeping you in the Democratic Party? Why not form a third party?
We're not in the Democratic Party.
Why not? Well, that's true, but you're endorsing the Democratic Party. Why
we're
not throw your support?
We're not endorsing the Democratic Party.
You're supporting,
Party.
Well, President Clinton.
We endorse candidates of both parties that support our issues. It just so happens that more of those candidates right now happen to be Democrat because more Democrats happen to support working people's issues. And once again, we will have died and gone to heaven. It'll be nirvana when we have both parties clamoring to support working people's issues. Now, why stay with the Democrats? I think historically the Democratic Party has represented workers, and we will yet to see in the near future whether they will continue to. I think right now workers are assessing that. Workers are saying, is this the party that represents workers? And I think the vast majority of the Democratic leadership on the House side and the Senate side would very easily pass that test because they do stand up for workers' issues. They stood up for Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security. They stand up for workers' right to bargain.
What about welfare?
I'm disappointed in that one. I mean, I really am. We're disappointed in that one, particularly because there's going to be 1.1 million children who are going to end up suffering because of that bill, that there were casualties of a political ball. And I think I would have liked to seen a little more courage with people standing up and say, yeah, there is room for reform here, but these children shouldn't pay the price.
I'd like to ask you.
We shouldn't make them pay the price. I mean, it really saddens me when I think about what's going to happen to those kids.
Richard, I'd like to ask you in terms of where the organizing efforts now within the organized labor movement. Obviously, you've had a union summer campaign that's had a tremendous impact. You've expanded your organizing institute in terms of funds. But you've got this incredible problem that you have to exponentially increase union membership just to be able to keep pace and increase the percentage. Given the fact that there are so many laws now favoring employers and making it difficult to win union elections, or even once you win an election to get a contract, how would you assess so far the success of this campaign, especially in the private sector? The politicians love unions in the public sector because it helps them marshal their votes. But what about in the private sector?
Well, you're absolutely right. We have to organize about 325,000 people net gain each year just to stay even with the percentage. To gain 1% a year, we have to organize 1,250,000 workers net gain each year. To do that, it's going to take a large infusion of new money and new resources and a new commitment by the labor movement. Now, the labor laws really are antiquated and bad, and they're against us. And we really do want to change them to make it easier for people to get a union and to have collective bargaining. But we simply cannot wait to do anything until that happens.
Richard Trumka, Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO and former president of the United Mine Workers. Up next, Alexander Coburn and a spokesperson for the DNC. Stay with us. And this is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman with my co-host Larry Bensky, national affairs correspondent, and Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News. And we're joined now by Alex Coburn. Alexander Coburn is co-author of Washington Babylon and a longtime columnist for The Nation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Oh, nice to be here.
What are you doing here?
I'm sort of suddenly realizing that Francis Fukuyama was right.
History's over.
History's over. This is the end of history.
We still got 40 minutes to go on the show, so we have to figure something out.
And 2 days of this convention.
Two more days of the convention. Well, Alex, when the New York Times' leading so-called thinker says in his lead piece that this is a convention run by revisionists determined to obscure, if not rewrite, recent history to the electoral advantage of the Republican Party, we need the New York Times seems to be getting it right.
I told you, it's the end of history.
The New York Times got the end of history right. What can you add?
I don't know. There's exciting times ahead. We have a candidate going on a lot about Bob Dole's best pledge.
Which is?
Abolish the IRS. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is big news, no? I mean, here is the leading fiscal collection agency of the state, and Bob Dole says he wants to abolish it.
So there'll be no tax revenue?
What? There'll be no tax revenue.
It'll all be honorary pledge. I pledge to send in my
taxes. No, let's follow it through a little bit. I mean, after all, if a candidate makes a major economic plan, we're meant to think about what it means. Okay, you, Larry Bensky, I know you're going to run one day. You promised to abolish the IRS, which is a clear crowd-pleasing maneuver, right? Everyone wants to abolish the IRS. He said, we'll abolish the IRS as we know it, which is a little echo of someone else who says they'll abolish something else as we know it, the welfare plan. So even more people hate taxes than they hate welfare, right? Now the Bensky plan is unleashed, and you've got to explain yourself. So you don't collect any more taxes, which means that we all spend the money the way we want. Now, that means that the Federal Reserve has to pay for the government. That means that they have to print up bonds, or they have to print up a lot of money. That means that you have to go to the man who really runs the country, who is?
The person who runs the bond market on Wall Street.
And?
Alan Greenspan.
You've got it. Alan Greenspan.
Maybe I will run for office. I do have all the answers.
You do. You're so quick. And Alan Greenspan has to say, we're going to permit rates of growth far in excess of what he's ever permitted. So suddenly the Dole plan requires that we go shooting along at a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% rate of growth. Because remember, he's going to balance the budget as well. And he's not doing what Reagan did, which is to unleash a huge arms spending boom, which was, of course, good for the economy, bad morally. But now Alan Greenspan does what he always does, which is to crank up interest rates, delightful to the bond market, pleasurable to Wall Street, and this stops the Dole recovery in its tracks. The Dole plan collapses.
Well, Alex, you make, I think, a very good point here, as we say in chat radio, but...
I thought that was talk. That's not chat. I went for the high ground right away.
We should talk about Radio Row one of these days, by the way, that appalling series of Scylla and Charybdis along the upper balcony of the convention center where 49 right-wing talk show hosts chirp in harmony all day long, interviewing each other and interviewing the Republican delegates. But what I wanted to ask you is, this economic question, you know, the 15% buttons that the Republicans are wearing, symbolizing his, they say it symbolizes a tax cut. I say it symbolizes by how many points Dole's going to lose the country, 15%.
Oh, very unwise to say this, Larry.
You don't think he's going to lose by 15%?
No, no.
How many percent is he going to lose by?
4 or 5.
Mm-hmm. Well, be that as it may, do you think that the electorate can be portrayed or thought of as dumb enough to say, oh, yeah, he's going to cut my taxes and the IRS is going to be cut out and therefore I'm going to vote for these guys? I mean, is that too simplistic by far?
I don't think the electorate is dumb. I think the electorate sees 15% tax cut and thinks that's great. I mean, you think 15% tax cut and you have a lot of mature Benskian thoughts because you have to talk about it all day long.
Right, Richard Daley only offered $5 a vote, and here the Republicans are offering every American a tax credit. Vote for us, and you got more money.
You see, I think the left, in a way, always misses on the tax issue because they think tax cuts are immoral because they think it's going to be taken out on the backs of the poor, which is usually in some way true, of course. But that's what I mean. You've got to sort of go through and say it's good to have a 15% tax cut. Let's accept. It's wonderful to wipe out the IRS. You could do it, actually. It's intellectually okay. You have to accept that. But then you have to say, well, now, what are you going to do next about Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve? Now, you actually have on the ticket Jack Kemp, and I wish I brought it with me. I have a letter in my possession from the vice presidential nominee, Mr. Kemp, praising me wildly years ago for attacking the previous chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker. He used to actually, he inserted a plank in the Republican platform of 1984, You were probably there, Larry, like me.
I was, and I remember that plank, as a matter of fact.
He pretty much said he'd wipe out the Federal Reserve. This is very radical stuff.
Right.
So where is Jack Kemp today? Now, he's back down on immigration. He's back down on
affirmative action.
Every shred of humanity he ever managed to attract to his person. And he's better than most of them, actually, I have to say, in many ways. What's he now going to do about the Fed?
Well, let me quote Jack Kemp here in today's Washington Post, speaking with David Broder. Jack Kemp says when
snoozing
pressed,
with David Broder, please. Yes, snoozing
right,
with David Broder.
It wasn't pressed very hard by David Broder, but slightly on these flip-flops. And Jack Kemp says, you'll like this one, I might abandon an idea, but not an ideal. I can change politically without changing my principles.
Isn't that pretty? Isn't that lovely?
Now, how can you go?
I bet you won't say that when you're running for president, Larry.
I can abandon idea, but not an ideal. I can change politically without changing my principles. There it is.
It's wonderful. I told you we're in post-history. You have, after all, you have Colin Powell saying, attacking corporate welfare. Can you imagine if Jesse Jackson had made that speech, which he, most of which he probably could have made, right? I don't know how many words you would have had to
but
change.
But Colin Powell had the common sense to leave immediately after making his speech and say, and says now that don't get the wrong idea that I'm going to campaign for you as well.
Well, he's campaigning for Secretary of State. I mean, they're putting out now that it's going to be put around the country during this campaign is if you get Dolan Kemp, you get a third person, you get a built-in Secretary of State.
What was the grimmest moment of the convention so far?
Arriving here in San Diego and realizing I was going to be 2 weeks in this environment.
Oh, I love San Diego. Wasn't the grimmest moment the sudden appearance of Henry Kissinger on that film?
I miss
Henry,
that.
This it is Henry Kissinger in the film on Ronald Reagan, but that would introduce Nancy Reagan.
Everything, that first night, the Republicans have learned how to cry. You know, they've never stopped crying now.
I think
this post-history, you see, this is the first convention not held under the shadow of war, right? We had the Cold War. Then in 1992, the triumph, the conquest of Iraq was still fresh in our nostrils. We were mad with excitement. Now there's absolutely no discussion of war. Have you heard the mighty ships in the harbor here being invoked once by any politician?
During the platform committee, they actually talked about having a strong defense and not abandoning.
Well, the
our
day the Republican committee, right. All that doesn't talk about a strong defense, you know, will be in post history, but not a word about war.
Well,
so I think once you've got the discipline of war, the whole Cold War thing gone, they don't really, not everything's up for grabs. Newt Gingrich can say whatever he wants. Colin Powell can talk about corporate welfare. The only thing that pulled us back into history, horrible history, was Henry Kissinger.
Well, what about the beach volleyball question? I rather enjoyed that
one.
The invocation of the symbol of freedom being the creation of beach volleyball as an Olympic sport.
This is the whole curve of the Republican Party. Remember we had Watt. Remember when Watt denounced the Beach Boys?
James Watt, yeah, the Secretary of Interior, yes.
And Reagan had to spring to the Beach Boys' defense?
Right.
We go from there to Newt Gingrich saying that for him, the essence of freedom, the Hegelian center of freedom, is the right to elevate beach volleyball to Olympic status. Who says there isn't progress in human affairs?
Well, somebody, a wise and insightful political reporter named Amy Goodman, from time to time says, why are we always talking
wise
about things?
Wise from time to time?
No, always wise, but from time to time she says, why are we always talking about the things that don't matter 99% of the time and 1% of the time about the things that do matter? For example, the military budget is an item she constantly brings up. Why is 99%? Why is 99% of the talk about welfare and tax cuts and 0% of the time spent on the military budget? Why?
You know the answer as well as I do. I mean, the military people can hit back. You know, it's been the underpinning of the American economy since 1938.
In fact, it's one of the biggest applause lines Colin Powell got was talking about strengthening the military. We're talking to Alexander Coburn. He is a columnist with The Nation magazine, and he is co-author of a new book called Washington Babylon. Now, people may wonder what you really are doing here, you know, day to day, what you spend your time doing, Alex.
Oh, what I spend my time doing? Oh, well, you know, it's like all conventions. You spend, 60% of the time in a state of numbed stupefaction looking at people you vaguely remember from 4 years earlier walking by. I mean, people have an idea. I don't know, do people have an idea of reporters actually running around with notebooks in which they inscribe important observations?
Most of the reporters I've seen here are actually talking to other
here.
Reporters.
He looks pretty energetic. What?
Most of the reporters I've seen here spend most of their time talking to other reporters. Have you noticed
there's
that?
There's a lot of talking to other reporters. Actually, this
there's three reporters for every delegate. There's plenty of time.
That's true. I made a conscious decision not to talk to too many other reporters this
time.
Well,
we feel honored that you've broken that vow.
And I withdrew myself to the great corporate emblems of San Diego, SeaWorld and the zoo.
And how were they?
Very interesting. Nature completely transmuted into corporate appendages.
Speaking of being transmuted, you've been a transmuted Californian for several years now.
Careful. People think that's a sex change or something.
Although you do live in a rather atypical part of California, the far frozen north. What do you make of Pete Wilson's diminished stature within this entire party?
One of the great joys of this convention is to see to see that horrible little prune face shrunken into an expression of petulant rage. If we have to thank Haley Barbour and Paul Manafort and the artificers of this convention for any one thing, it is the reduction of Pete Wilson to his even more diminutive status.
On the other hand,
I think he's, I don't know what you think, I think he's one of the most loathsome politicians in America.
Well, I think he probably could be quoted
Gonzalez,
as
saying, we've got a few in New York.
I knew typical New York chauvinism. He
that might lay claim to that.
I think that Pete Wilson would probably say he might abandon an idea, but not an ideal. He can change politically without changing his principles. I mean, this should be made into a T-shirt immediately.
I know.
Or a banner or something. A bumper sticker.
A Pacifica fundraiser.
Really?
Well, we have just been... We're going to see if we're going to be joined by someone else. We're hoping to be joined by a spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee. Maybe they heard you, Alex. I don't know, but they're not here right now. I don't know if you've had much chance to watch TV over the last few days, but we were commenting earlier in the show about the disproportionate coverage or the number of black faces you see on TV. You see a lot of them for the GOP convention.
Absolutely. The ethnic, class, and sexual composition of this convention floor has changed four times each evening. Actually, it goes back historically. It's quite interesting. When Buchanan made his famous speech in 92, and everyone in America thought the Nuremberg rally had been held in Houston, leading to probably an important hike for Bill Clinton. Actually, I was in the hall with my brother Patrick, who's a reporter too. And he's a real reporter. He likes to actually go and watch things. And I was, of course, needless to say, wanted to sit in the bar and look out for you. And he said, let's go listen to Buchanan. I said, oh, well, go and watch it on television. He said, no, let's actually physically go and listen. We went into the hall, the main hall, not the little sub-hall where all the reporters were watching.
This is the Houston Astrodome, right?
Astrodome. Yeah. And we went and we stood right under Pat Buchanan's podium. It was not like the present one. This was a proper Nuremberg podium, right. You know, like that. Okay. And we stood... All around us were the Republican delegates, and Pat cranked into this speech. You could immediately see the delegates thought, oh, God, this is disaster. Many of them were openly deriding Buchanan, shouting no, watching I Love Lucy reruns on the TV monitors. In other words, giving every impression that they thought this was a stupid, ridiculous speech. If the CNN cameraman had not been doing what he always does, which is when Buchanan talks about defiance and values, you know, a lot of rigid faces all streaming with sweat and the lust for blood, if they'd shown actually what was going on, which is a lot of Republicans saying, oh, they get on with this. I mean, hook, get him off. It would have been totally different. It was the same thing. He was trapped. The Republicans are trapped by their own techniques.
We are joined right now by a spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee. He's David Eichenbaum, and you're joining a discussion with Larry Bensky, Juan Gonzalez, and Andrew Coburn, as well as myself, Amy Goodman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Would that it were, Andrew. It's actually Alexander.
What did I say?
You said I'm Andrew Coburn. That's Alexander Coburn.
Sorry.
It's all right.
You look just like him.
Andrew's
look
a
just
very
like
nice
him.
Guy.
welcome to Democracy Now! David. Tell us what you are doing here.
Well, we're here as a bit of a truth squad to provide perspective from the other side, because we think, especially after last night, it's sorely needed.
Which bit of the truth are you telling in your bit of a truth squad?
Well, in part, we're responding to attacks on the president, which we saw plenty of last night. In part, we are trying to get out some of the things that the Republicans sort of are not saying, but are thinking. We have seen last night, for instance, an incredible show of personal animosity and negativity. And one of the things that we're just trying to do in a very open way is to just provide some perspective.
Come on, Eichenbaum, we know what you're really doing. You're looking for new ideas.
Well, we didn't hear too many of them last night.
Well, don't you expect the Republicans to show up in Chicago with exactly the same... firepower, as it were, and do the same thing?
Absolutely. We did it in Houston in 92. They were in New York in 92. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it, and it's sort of standard procedure at this point. Everyone expects it. And one of the things that we did, we've done the most of this week, is just interviews, talking to the press. It's, you know, we're not here spying. We're here just providing our side of the story.
Well, what do you make of General Powell's speech, since he's a favorite of the Clinton administration as well as of the Republicans? To what degree do you have any problems with his presentation of the truth?
No problems with it. I thought it was a good speech. I wish he was a Democrat.
What about Susan Molinari's joke that she opened with in her speech? She said, my speech is just going to be like a Clinton promise, short-lived and sound Republican.
I think that actually, if you go through the promises that the president made in 1992, you will find that he has kept just about all of them. And it's nice it's a nice attack line, and it sounds good, and it sounds strong, but it just isn't true. Just as they say that the 1993 deficit reduction package had the largest tax increase in history, that's not true either. The 82 tax package that Bob Dole pushed through as chairman of the Finance Committee was, and what they don't tell you is that the only taxes that were raised in 1983 were those in the top 1.2% of taxpayers. So you're not getting the full story when you're just listening to the speeches.
Now, Mr. Eichenbaum, when Kemp was first nominated, I think the first response of your crowd was to attack him from the right and to say that he was irresponsible and he mightn't be sober enough on the deficit. Do you think economically the Democratic Party and its policy is actually to the right of the Republicans?
To the right of the Republicans? Look, I don't want to talk right or left, but in terms of Jack Kemp, I think there is no one.
Why don't you want to talk right or left?
There's no one in the Democratic Party right now who is out there saying Jack Kemp is an extremist. I mean, that's just, look, it's not an attack that holds any credibility. People don't believe that, and as a person, he's not. But if you look at some of his specific views, which is what we have been trying to do, whether it be...
Well, he just changed them. You've got to keep up.
He did just change them, didn't he? Good, I don't have to talk about that.
Well, your guy does the same thing, but, so you must be used to it.
But whether it be the balanced budget, he says that it's not important and it's not a priority. Whether it be the returning to the gold standard, the only other people who support that are Lyndon LaRouche, Jesse Helms, the John Birch Society.
Wait a minute, and the Wall Street Journal, come on.
Well, the Wall Street Journal editorial page.
That's the beating heart.
We're not talking about mainstream economic ideas here.
David, a lot of people aren't talking about it here, but everywhere else we go, this concern about President Clinton agreeing to throw more than a million kids into poverty with the welfare reform bill, as you call it, what many call welfare repeal. How do you justify it in this election year, or is that just the justification? It's the election year.
Look, the president, one of the things that the president has been most concerned about since he was elected, and even before, was welfare. He made it, as everyone knows, he made it a major plank of his 92 election, and it is very important to him. That is, in terms of throwing kids into poverty, that happens to be why he vetoed two Republican welfare reform bills. For two reasons. One, he didn't think that they were strong enough in terms of a work requirement. But two, he thought that they were way too harsh to innocent children. And does he think that the bill that he signed is perfect? Absolutely not. He thought it was the last best chance for quite a while to get any kind of meaningful welfare reform. Does he like everything in there? No. Did he make some significant changes before he signed it? Yes. Does it need to do more to protect children? Yes. And he is going to work to change those provisions that he doesn't like.
And what if he doesn't get reelected? Then they're just in place and as extreme as anything that's ever been presented.
And what happens in Chicago? Do you expect some sort of opposition from the Democratic delegates to what many people consider to be these draconian and inhumane provisions in the welfare bill that he signed?
It's hard to predict what kind of reaction there'll be and what kind of protests there'll be at our convention. Certainly there will be some outside.
David, can I ask you one question? Doesn't it mean that when he did this, it really got Gingrich off the hook? Because it used to be the do-nothing Congress. By signing that bill, he basically allowed the Republicans with Gingrich to say, we made him sign it.
I think that what he was thinking about was, what do I need to do to fix this problem? And, you know, everyone can look at it in political terms, but the president believed very strongly that this issue needed to be dealt with. And whether the Republican Congress gets partial credit or someone else gets partial credit, so what? We got to deal with the problem.
David, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. I want to thank you for joining us. David Eichenbaum is a spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee, and I just have to comment that I thought it was interesting the same week that President Clinton said he'd sign off on welfare repeal. He was asking the television execs how they're going to not only cater to all children for more television programming, but particularly poor children. And I thought, well, he should be particularly concerned about that since he's making a million more of them poor in this country.
I have a lot more time to watch television.
I want to thank Alexander Coburn very much for joining us from The Nation magazine. And Juan Gonzalez and Larry Bensky are with me, Amy Goodman, as we continue with our program, Democracy Now! Stay with us.
This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Juan Gonzalez joins us for this segment. And today we're going to take a look at African Americans in the GOP. If you've been watching TV coverage of the GOP convention this week, you've probably noticed that the convention floor is flooded with red, white, and blue. Red blazer, blue suits, and white faces. A literal sea of flag-waving white folk. Only 3% of the delegates here are African Americans, and according to a new report, even that represents a huge decline from 1992. Let's hear from J.C. Watts, Black Republican from Oklahoma.
These people are working in the trenches and suffering with those who suffer. They understand compassion. They understand compassion can't be dispensed from a safe distance by a faceless bureaucrat sitting in an air-conditioned office in Washington, D.C. And while we're on the subject of compassion, it was just about 4 years ago that I was privileged to address the GOP convention. It was at that time that I talked about how the Republican definition of compassion was different than the Democrats. You see, Republicans don't define compassion by how many people are on AFDC and public housing and on food stamps. You see, we define compassion by how few people are on food stamps and AFDC and public housing.
Oklahoma Republican Congressmember J.C. Watts speaking at the Republican Convention. We're joined now by two people, David Basaitis with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, a black think tank in Washington, D.C. He's authored a new report on blacks in the 1996 Republican National Convention. And we're also joined by Doris Mitchell Oliveira, an African-American alternate delegate from Macon County, Alabama. She's a veterinarian and a lifelong member of the GOP who comes from many generations of Republican activists. What draws your family to the Republican Party?
Well, there was nothing else that they could be. My grandparents came from Texas, San Marcos, Texas. My mother's side of the family was in Beckley, West Virginia. And as far as they knew, they didn't know anybody that was, all the Republicans they knew were black. When I grew up, most of the Republicans I knew were black, except when we'd go to very big rallies in Chicago. And we'd see other white faces, but that's just the only thing we knew to be.
But clearly over the years that began to change as more and more African Americans entered in the Democratic Party, and but yet you remained in the Republican Party, so there must have been clear choices that you made along the way, the things that drew you to one party versus the other.
Well, my grandmother was a ward healer in Chicago, and she was totally against the Daley machine, and her lifelong things were just to do what she could against the Daley machine.
So you moved down from Chicago, down south, and what did you see of the Democratic Party in Alabama? What did that represent to you?
Well, the Democrat Party in Alabama, and I don't call it Democratic, I call it Democrat Party, in Alabama, was a party that was involved totally in segregation. Actually, black people, until very recently, could not even be members of the Democrat Party. They had to form these little Democrat clubs, and these Democrat clubs would handle the minority votes in various communities. And the strength in the Democrat parties right now is because of the strong things that they've had to do, the strong influence they've had in controlling the local votes.
You know, some members of the Alabama delegation on the floor are wearing Confederate flag stickers. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? What do you think of it?
Right. Well, back at the Southern Regional Committee meeting down in Mobile, Alabama, there were a group of kids, from South Carolina that had T-shirts that had the stars and bars, and on the top of it, it said, "Abraham Lincoln's worst nightmare." And we forced them to move those from the hall. The chairman of our party has discussed it with these people that put these on. They put these on at the convention, and I'm just glad it's history. But to a lot of Southerners, they think the Republican Party began with Barry Goldwater. They don't think it has any history any deeper, any earlier than that. And I, what I do usually is just say, welcome to my party. It's the Black Party of America. And it kind of unwinds a lot of them.
Well, and yet we do have the reality that at this convention, there are half the number of African-American delegates and alternates that there were at the previous convention. And there is a sense, of in the, even in the Latino community, that the Republican Party has begun an even greater assault on the Latino community than in past conventions. How do you reconcile the fact that, on the one hand, many of the African-American political leaders have got much greater play and promotion at the on the convention floor, but the composition of the delegates is so distinct this time?
Well, I'll just speak particularly about Alabama. There, when I first came back to the Republican Party after I've lived overseas a lot of years, in '88 there were maybe 8 or 9 members of the state executive committee that were elected. These are elective officers, and as the Republican Party has picked up members and interest in white communities, there are more and more people that are joining. And because these are all elective positions, you have to run to become a delegate. You have to, I got 21,000. You either run in a district race or you run in the state at large. I ran in the state at large, and it takes a lot of extra effort. Before, it didn't take as much effort to be a delegate, but you have to now run, and in the southern areas especially, you have to run against white people. And there are more white people that are willing to come out and vote and become Republicans. And blacks are just being very reticent. We're not voting in large numbers in either Democrat or Republican primaries.
The affirmative action planks, the planks that deal with immigration, how do you feel about them? What is your position, for example, on affirmative action?
Well, actually, I'd like people to come. I hope we have everybody's brains to come. But I think that people should really become members of this of America. They should become citizens, and they should pay taxes. I don't think it's fair that people bring their relatives in under the guise of the fact that they're going to support them, you know, for the rest of their lives, and then suddenly, if they haven't worked and earned,
people who are escaping poverty, say in Mexico, and part of that poverty caused by the United States, U.S. corporations mm-hmm. going in, and they go there, of course, so that they can pay almost no wages and have very exploitive conditions, and that forces people into this country to look for something better. What do you think of that?
Then they should come and become citizens and pay taxes. I think they should be welcome in this country.
And affirmative action?
Well, I think that it takes a little extra effort sometimes to become a member of groups. And I think we still need affirmative action in a lot of areas for people that are undereducated and underexposed to the possibilities of life here.
Let's bring David Basaitis into this conversation with the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. You did a report on black Republicans. Does Doris Mitchell Oliveira sort of fit the profile of people that you interviewed?
Actually, I didn't interview anybody. It's a statistical profile of the delegates to the Republican convention. The Joint Center has done guides to the Republican and Democratic conventions going back to 1972 when the Democratic Party reformed its rules. And over the years, we have calculated how many black delegates there were at different Republican conventions and what the correlates were and such. There really is no simple profile of who the black delegates are, except that they tend to be from the states where black voters live. Unfortunately, the Republican Party rules have a significant bias towards what I call the white belt, the area of the country where no black Americans live. I mean, there are about 28 states that only have 4% of the black population in the United States, and many of those states have grossly disproportional representation in the Republican Party. Wyoming has as much representation on the Republican National Committee as California, and there are 3 times as many African Americans in California as there are people in Wyoming.
I was looking at the part of your report, by the way, called Blacks in the 1996 Republican National Convention, where you talk about the Dole record. To African Americans, there are two faces to the Dole record. One is Bob Dole with green eye shades, a man concerned with balanced budgets, tax policy, and farm programs. Running for the presidency, he has had to position himself quite far to the right, as Richard Nixon had suggested to him, in order to win the nomination. His association with Gingrich and House Republican freshmen has not endeared him to African Americans, despite the fact that his relationship with a Republican freshman has frequently been strained. What supports what you found here?
You mean that observation about Bob Dole? Well, in terms of Bob Dole's record in the United States Congress, Bob Dole frequently mentions that he voted against all of the Great Society programs during the 1960s, but that's not actually true. There were two things he voted for. The two things he voted for were the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In 1982, when the Voting Rights Act was revised, and it was the 1982 revision of the Voting Rights Act that created all of the new black districts in the South, that sent the large number of new black members to Congress in 1993, Bob Dole was one of the leaders of the effort to revise the Voting Rights Act in 1982. And then in 1991, when the Civil Rights Act of 1991 was passed, Bob Dole was very, very instrumental in the passage of the 1991 Civil Rights Act.
David, I have a question. There are three black congressmen who are all Republicans who all come from...
Two.
Okay, who come from majority white districts. What do you make of that? Who's electing them, and why have there been... has it been so far a situation where you have not had a Republican congressman elected from a majority black district?
Well, they're not just majority white districts. I believe you might want to characterize them as lily white districts. They're some of the whitest districts in the country. And on one level, I find it a very good thing. The white voters are willing to elect African Americans to office, and white Republicans are willing to elect African Americans to office, if, of course, they're conservatives and they basically follow the Republican Party line. I don't consider that a bad thing. But on the other hand, J.C. Watts and Gary Franks are in Washington, as they should be, representing white people. They're not here representing black people. There are
Would you agree to that? Would you agree with that, Doris Mitchell?
That they're representing more white. There's no way that black people generally cannot represent black people, even if they come from white districts.
Well,
because our experiences are so inbred.
I have to somewhat disagree with that. A good representative who is elected to represent all of the voters in their district, if they're in a district that is overwhelmingly white. If they're doing a good job, had better be representing those white voters.
No, I don't really know, because I haven't really followed his voting records. But I don't know whether he's an active member of the so-called Black Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus.
J.C. Watts didn't join the Black Caucus, and Gary Franks did join the Black Caucus. He's had a stormy relationship, but he is. Associated with the Black Caucus.
Although he pushed hard to end its funding, isn't that right, as part of the Republican push to end the funding for all of the caucuses, though that disproportionately hit caucuses of color.
His support was actually quite irrelevant. The Republicans intended to butcher all the caucuses as soon as they took over the Congress, Gary Franks or no Gary Franks.
You know, yesterday when we first met Doris Mitchell Oliveira, you were talking about your experiences in the South during the Civil Rights Movement, and also with Malcolm X. How did you meet him?
Well, he was coming to Tuskegee Institute to speak, and I was working on the faculty at Tuskegee Institute at the time. And I went to the airport to pick him. I picked him up from the airport. I was working in the Civil Rights Movement. Actively, there were a number of Republicans that were actively working. We were driving cars. I wasn't living in tent cities, and I was not in any nonviolent demonstration, because I don't believe in nonviolence, you know, against people that are extremely violent. And there are a number of people that, you know, I think that those lines should have been lines of people that look like dock workers, you know, and not children and people. I didn't see King. subjecting his children to the brutalization of those of policemen. They weren't kicking his children and making his kids wipe up urine with shoelaces. And I don't think any children should have been forced for any reason to endure that kind of humiliation and bruising. And so I was absolutely against it. And they didn't stop having children march until Malcolm X got to the church in Selma. And he's the one that forced, and they were getting, there was nobody over eight that was out of jail except Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson. Everybody else was in jail. I think Bevel might have been out of jail too. And they were just totally, you know, getting large numbers of kids. They were getting ready to do another march, and there wasn't any older person. And Malcolm X made them stop, feed those children, and, you know, and then by noon they were out.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And very quickly, Dave Bisaitis, if people want to get a copy of your report, where can they call?
They can call the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies in Washington, 202-789-3500.
That's 202-789-3500. Thank you very much, Doris Mitchell Oliveira, African-American delegate from Macon County, Alabama. And thank you to David Bisaitis of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, engineered by Michael Yoshida. Our convention team includes Juan Gonzalez and Larry Bensky. If you'd like a copy of today's show, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow we talk to Chuck Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity on money in the Republican convention. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks very much for joining us.